Today, a new book has come, which is lying there, called Living with Faith and Patience. This is on the teachings of Shirdi Sai Baba. And what happened was, during the pandemic, there was a series of interviews on the YouTube channel Sai Baba Devotee Speaks. That channel became very popular because everyone was in distress. Sai Baba has hundreds of thousands of followers. And so we decided to do these interviews where we could bring Sai Baba's teachings into daily living. So it was an interview format with Nikhil, who's the founder of the channel, and myself. So it gave me the opportunity to present Sai Baba's teachings through the lens of Advaita. Up till now, there have been many books on Sai Baba's miracles. So, what we endeavor to do is go behind the miracles to see what is the message being conveyed to us, to understand that. Because there were, as Nikhil would tell me, many misperceptions about Sai Baba's teachings. For example, one of them was Baba's keywords were Shraddha and Saburi, faith and patience. But this word faith, according to my understanding, was generally mistaken to be faith that I will get what I want. Whereas Baba was saying to have faith in the divine will, which may or may not be what you want, but what is meant for you. So, I mean, in the process, we must have burst a few bubbles, but that is truly, I thought it's worthy of delving into these concepts of Baba. And so we found that beyond the pandemic, his subscribers wanted more and more exploration. That was a pleasant surprise because I told him that these videos would be the least viewed on your channel because they are not enthralling. We are not speaking about Sai Baba appearing in my vision and holding my hand and taking me to the sun. None of that is there, you know. So teachings tend to get a bit boring, you could say, because they don't have juice. But I stuck by the words of Ramana Maharshi when he said the greatest siddhi is peace of mind. So while all those miracles took place, I think what Sai Baba was pushing is this peace and tranquility. This saburi, patience, is not to patiently wait till I get what I want. It is a way of being in the moment, waiting patiently for the divine will to unfold without the me trying to push for an outcome. Once again, that is my understanding of saburi. Someone may have some other dimension to it. So it is a series of about 50, 55 interviews. It's a question-answer format. It's free-flowing, very simple. It covers a vast range of topics. So if it's something that interests you, the book is lying there. And in August sometime, we will be making a day trip to Shirdi, to Sai Baba's Samadhi, and we will have a satsang there. We are looking for a venue, a hall, and it will be announced, so everyone is welcome to come. We may or may not spend a night there. We are working on it, but we could be together for a couple of hours in Shirdi itself. And the greatest validation, because I was a doubting Thomas. I would tell Nikhil, this is not going to work. This is not going to work. Nobody is going to appreciate this. And towards the end of the interviews, he found a book which was long forgotten. It's called Scribblings, based on Sai Baba's teachings. And that book came out decades ago. And in that book, the author who was inspired by Sai Baba wrote that in future, there will be people who will speak about Baba's teachings and not just his miracles. So it was a validation that the time had come for this. So Atik, I'm sorry I could not invite you in yesterday.
I was uninvited guest. It's not the latest part.
No, my mother was doing the last part of her it was a 4 Saturday series on Zoom.
I hope I didn't disturb it.
No, but she had some of her students here, and there was no room to bring you in and make you sit anywhere because I was also attending the class. So,
I'm sorry I disturbed.
No, not at all. I'll tell you something funny. It's time for my haircut, but I've not had time for it. Now, normally, I just the morning of the haircut or the night before, I call the barber and say, I'm coming, you better be free at so and so time. So he doesn't take another assignment. But for some strange reason, for 2 days, I've been thinking not only about my haircut, but of him. It's very peculiar. So what happened was, when you came, my maid came into my bedroom and said, someone called Atik has come. I said, my thoughts are so powerful that my barber, whose name is also Atik, has landed up here. That was my first thought. And in COVID, he used to come home. I said, this is really ridiculous, you know. So I went to the door expecting the barber. And he was standing there. He said, I've come from Bangalore and I'm staying in the hotel next door. So it begets the question, which Atik was I thinking of? So first time here.
Yeah, this time.
And the last time we met was in which retreat?
Last this year, Tiruvannamalai, I missed.
The year before
Last
that. And how have things been since then? Just okay?
year. As you said, patience. Being in the now.
You can take that for the recording. So you were just okay for a long time and then you came here.
Yeah, I think that okayness got me here. Yeah.
In a negative way or
No, it
positive
was
way?
not.
In a positive way, yeah.
And you were shuttling between Bangalore and Chennai, from what I remember.
Still doing the same.
Okay. Work is good.
It's all floating, getting along. They say testing time, so as you said, thy will be done. Yeah. So as you said, you will something, God's will is something else. So I think that merging has to happen in me, where my will and God's will become one. I think that time has come.
So
But
that's
what would
why.
that mean, according to you? What would, at that point, what would happen?
Surrender. Surrender to what is. Complete acceptance without any resistance to what is. Your mind wants something, your heart wants something. So noticing when the mind comes into play and accepting that this mind is playing up and allowing it to go. So right now I'm in a point where the mind plays up. I recognize the mind, but I get entangled for some time. And when I get entangled, it's so painful. It's very painful. But I come out of it. It takes time.
But you would still have to exercise your will even in the future. Even when the merging happens, you still have to take a decision. The problem is, we question whether the decision we take, is it going to be right or wrong?
Right or wrong. You think of the end result before. When you take a decision, you feel this could be the end result. You expect a result out of
Yes,
it.
you expect a certain result which suits you.
Suits you. So I'm in the process now where I don't want to expect results and just do without any expectations. So just as you said, patience. Yeah.
So when that happens, I'm still exercising my will, which is based on my genetics and my conditioning, my buddhi. But now I'm freed of this burden I carry that it is my decision.
Yeah.
So when I'm freed of that burden, there's no guilt and shame if it turns out to be wrong, and there's no pride and arrogance if it turns out to be right. Yes.
In a sense that my will and thy will can exist, coexist at the same time.
Right now,
Yes.
your question itself is God operating through you. So it is right now coexisting itself. It's not at a future point.
Can it ever happen? There is no my will, but only thy will.
Yes, when the sense of doership is uprooted, then your will, which you still have to exercise, you have the full knowing that it is God's will operating through me.
Till that time, it is
Yes.
both
You
in the
could
moment
say, yes.
coexist.
You could say that, but actually they don't. Actually, the source is rediscovering itself through inquiry and coming to the conclusion that truly my will is not as grand as I thought it was. Because life has shown me repeatedly how worthless my will truly is. yet exercise it I must. For example, as we said it in a couple of talks ago, I may exercise my will in choosing a certain flight to go to London, but the flight may not reach London. That is God's will. Yet, my will is also God's will because it was my destiny to be on that flight. You see? So everything is God's will. What is happening is the ego, its most precious treasure is the sense of doership which it has been holding on to since it was a child. Now this child, which is still here, is understanding I need to let this go. And if I revel in pure being, which I used to as a child, when the sense of separation and doership was not so strong, I find life is so much more simpler. The child is not busy convincing others of their point of view. Child consciousness is open, non-judgmental, and in the moment. So we are rediscovering that child consciousness. But as adults, we still have to operate on the basis of our will. So that is what the Gita points to. The ego deluded thinks I am the doer. That's all. And the clincher is the understanding that nor is anyone else the doer. No matter how convinced we are that they are the doers. There are some perpetrators in our lives who have been mean and nasty to us. But we must admit they come from the same source. There cannot be two different sources. And they come from that source and we come from this source. The source is one. And good and evil are the polarities of that one source consciousness. They are the polar opposites in life. So we classify some people as good and others as evil. Now, certainly we would not want to be with people who are disturbing our peace of mind. Who would want that? This teaching is not saying love them, forgive them, be with them. This teaching is saying accept them totally as an instrument of God, just as you are. In that, how does the love arise? That you wouldn't even wish pain upon that person. Otherwise, the old you might say, oh, I hate this person so much, something bad should happen to them. That dialogue goes because you have the total acceptance that the play of karma is happening. Everyone is an instrument on the chessboard of your life. And at the end of it, whether you are the bishop, king, queen, knight, castle, you are all going into the same box. So you live life with this understanding. You'll still be troubled by some, but because you have a total acceptance of them, you will exercise your will, your buddhi. How can I protect myself? How can I not lose my peace of mind? This particular relationship is hopeless, but there will be no hate. There will be no hate. There will be no condemnation. There will be no blame. That is finished. That is what happens. Yes, Seema, you all have come from a trip abroad, or you were
in Singapore for some time. But I came last time when you had the meditation course. I've written this down because what happens, I stumble. Yeah. So I'll just read it out to you. There has been a Mahabharata raging within me from past 10 days or so. My thinking mind goes into a state of overthinking, okay? So in spite of knowing that I am part of the problem, and I can't keep my emotions in check. So I'd like to know how to get out of this.
Express them. Yes.
If I do express it, then I become emotional.
Of course. Better to express than suppress.
And there has been confrontation most of the time, and I am unable to withdraw myself.
So even to see this, that in spite of my best effort, I am unable to withdraw myself, is enough to see the helplessness of it all. And that is called surrender. Be okay with not being okay. Because what happens is we punish ourselves. I was not able to control myself. The ego has come in through the back door. One just has to tell oneself, these emotions are not mine. I didn't choose them. Would I choose them? They are there based on past vasanas, sanskars, conditioning, you can call it what you want, which have created this me. And this me is the one that is suffering. I am the one who is aware that the me is suffering, because you are aware of your suffering. So who is that who is aware that they are suffering? It clearly means you are not the suffering. It doesn't mean it takes away your suffering. What one is pointing to is the witness. It is just seeing how helpless I am. All my so-called flaws and imperfections are coming out. This Mahabharata is going on and I can't do a damn about it. That is called surrender. Not my will, O Lord, but thine. If it was mine, I could have controlled it. So you have once again shown to me that it is all your play. The only thing is to explore and contemplate on these emotions. Are they based on what I think others have done to me? To just understand that, are these old patterns still operating where I think this one said this to me, so I got hurt, that one did this to me? Or is that part pretty sorted out?
I'd say sort of, not, you know, completely.
So even the sort of is a big thing, because earlier, before you were drawn to the teaching, the sort of was not there. That was full suffering. It takes time. Yes, there might be specific triggers. See, deep down, I believe we all know what is troubling us. There are some core issues. Usually it is related to trauma in one's formative years, which get triggered. Those trouble us and they keep coming up and up and up.
Coming up in different ways.
Yeah, it does come up in different ways. But you see, imagine, it's really unique how this works. Why are some people who've gone through hell in life drawn to spiritual inquiry and the spiritual path, and others who have gone through hell not even concerned about it? And I give this example of someone we know, a very distant relative, who has, I would say it's quite likely that she has seen more hell than most of the people in this room, no matter what they have seen, because I have a fair degree of experience with human interactions to conclude that. All sorts, financial, health is at the peak since the last 35 years, health issues and relationships, tattered relationships. But if anyone in her family tries to broach the subject that, why don't you come for a talk, why don't we go to this place, listen to this, whatever it is, the doors are shut. So that destiny is not to come onto the spiritual path. And what is the spiritual path? Nothing but questioning life. What is life about? Is this what is going on in life, or is there more to it? That's all. Even that has not happened. So one must be grateful to consciousness that even this much, it has pulled us out of the quicksand. That all these traits of the ego, these patterns, it may not dissolve them immediately, but at least they are coming to light. You know, there are people who are into yoga, sadhana. They are masters in their craft, but the personality has not changed. Now, because they are into yoga, they are aware that the personality is just impossible to change for them. For someone else, it can change. What are they battling? We don't know. You see, if you follow the Indian Hindu cycle of birth and rebirth, it is lifetimes of patterns.
All the karmas accumulated.
Lifetimes upon lifetimes of unconscious action-reaction loops keep playing out, keep playing out, keep playing out. So it takes time. By and by, we have to ask ourselves, are we more at peace now than we were earlier? That is the only criteria. Rather than focusing on our problems, emotions, whatever path you are on, whether it is Kriya Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Gyan Yoga, Karma Yoga, whatever, this question must be asked. Am I more at peace now than I was earlier? And if the answer is yes, you're in good hands.
Yes, but I know I'm becoming stronger, but when I'm triggered, I go back to this, you know, this emotional state.
I can imagine. And next time it happens, the dialogue can change. Instead of I am triggered, being triggered is happening. You see, the I am can never be triggered. I am is pure being, pure consciousness, right here, right now. The me is triggered. No one triggers you in deep sleep. Deep sleep is impersonal consciousness, which is right here, right now, but it has got identified with a body and a name. It is this identification which is getting triggered. So you should thank your stars that whenever you are triggered, the I am is not triggered, the me is triggered. Even that much knowing goes a long way. And what we are meant to suffer, we suffer with total acceptance and offer that suffering to God, to consciousness. We offer it back to consciousness. The problem is we take ownership of it as mine. We offer it to consciousness. Suffering is happening. Suffering is happening right here, right now. Although I am trying my best, suffering is happening. So be it. Thy will be done.
Thank you so much.
The point is, when suffering is not happening, do we remember that suffering is not happening? That is the point. I'm feeling a bit hot, or is it okay here temperature-wise? Because sometimes my body temperature goes a bit haywire. Usually I feel cold in this room. Today I'm feeling hot. This phantom ego is so mesmerizing. I mean, it's amazing. Can't be seen. Yet it is so solid.
Can't see the location of it.
Nothing. It just shows that God is playing a game. I have nothing to do with it. He makes it arise. He makes it subside. Whereas I think I am the one in charge of the ups and downs. The inquiry is the journey of this Jivatma to the Atma. The inquiry means the Jivatma is no longer lost in the mundane material world, but now has realized this material world cannot give me what I truly am looking for. And so that journey from the Jivatma to the Atma is one where you cannot reverse, hopefully. Because that pull has been planted in you, what one would call ascension, to ascend out of the mundane material towards the cosmic. So any satsang should not be underrated. It is a great gift. Because you are not here, I'm not going to show you a movie. I'm not going to play some game with you, razzle, puzzle, this, that, what's going on, right? Truth has pulled itself to truth. Truth has pulled itself to truth. So these are what actually life's journey is about. The others are projections, social projections, whatever they may be, different formats of projection. This is not a projection unless it becomes the spiritual ego. I am attending 5 satsangs. So then again that has happened. It happened to us once in our Dharamshala retreat that one couple came and I asked him, what brings you here? He said, oh, we go to attend everyone's satsangs. So we are here. So that is now something about the ego acquiring. I've been here, I've been here, I've been here, I've been here. Again, that can be a trap. So it is a beautiful journey. It is the journey of conscious suffering. Earlier unconscious, now conscious. And conscious suffering can burn even more because one is conscious of it. You see, it is when Bhagwan, I don't remember the details of the story, but there were some, I think, was it bird's eggs or some eggs, and he was having a bath and put his towel and knocked one down. And he immediately realized that it was a transgression, even though it was unconscious. And he nurtured that egg for a couple of days till it healed. So what does this mean? That someone who's the father of awareness, still, if it was unconscious, he would have forgotten about that egg which had fallen. I said, oh, too bad. So it can burn more. That story is in one of Ganesan's books, if I'm not mistaken. So we are very careful. We try not to offend people. We try. We try to watch our words when we are on the spiritual path. We are no longer as raw and untamed as we used to be, because we start developing a sensitivity that how would this other person feel when these words are spoken, because I know how I feel. So that is this kind of very beautiful journey of awareness and compassion. That's what starts up. The game of give and take drops away.
Guruji, as we say, that deep sleep state is most nearest to the real state which we talk about. But when we wake up, this waking state which we have, there is no memory of the deep sleep which we have. And as you say that now also, that state is present with us at this place. But we are not able to understand the difference, like, because we don't have the memory of the deep sleep. So this is difficult to understand that how that state is present with us. And the second thing is, once...
The first part is easy, because otherwise you'd be dead. You're still conscious. You were conscious in deep sleep, you are conscious now. So where is that consciousness gone? It doesn't go anywhere. Until the body drops dead, the consciousness is not going anywhere. It's not vacating the body in deep sleep, right? Does that answer your question? You see, it's two sides of a coin. Consciousness is all there is. In deep sleep, it is impersonal. There is no person there. In the waking and dream state, it is identified because the person is there. It doesn't mean consciousness has gone. Can one side of a coin go? So the coin is the coin of consciousness. Deep sleep, impersonal. Waking, personal.
The second thing is, when we are able to, like, understand what you are saying, so this understanding which we get it, so this doesn't stay constant throughout the day. It forgets itself and it identifies, like, whenever the eyes is open, whenever some things are seen in the world, it identifies with the other things. So how can we make this understanding constant throughout the day?
So one thing to note is the consciousness does not forget. It is the me which is identified which forgets. Why does it forget? Because it is operating on past patterns and conditioning, hardwired conditioning. It takes time to transform that conditioning. It happens gradually. What will happen is, I may repeat the same mistakes, but suddenly the awareness, my God, how did I do that if now I realize that we are not the doers? That is how the new understanding keeps shining. And by, over time, one finds that one is more in this new, operating from the new conditioning, until one is totally operating in that. Then you know that it has come and stood in front of you. So it is like you go to school, right? First standard, second standard, third standard, fourth standard. Then once you've learned the lessons, till then you have to study, do that. Once it is learned, you go to the next class. This is the school of life. Situations will constantly present themselves till the lesson is learned. You see, because it's got really nothing to do with what happens in my life. It is to do with what is inside. What is inside, in simpler words, means my attitude to what happens in my life. It is not something external. It is all my reactions, my resistances. And who is this me and my? That exploration. And that is why one finds by and by that from reaction, we are moving to response. Buttons may be pressed. Some old reactions may come up in certain situations. But we are less involved in those reactions. In what way? If I react and I realize, my God, I'm still reacting, it may not stop me from offering an apology to the person I've been rude to. Earlier, I would not. My ego would not allow it. So things change like this. So it happens by and by. It can take lifetimes. We don't know, but I keep saying what is more important is this turning around has happened. To even be aware that I'm repeating the same patterns is a very big step. Most people are living lives of unawareness in the lower three chakras. Some degree of awareness has set in which says, hey, the same pattern is being repeated. That awareness will do the job. It is a big step. What Maharaj called the turning away from the self, the small self, what he meant was, when we are no longer running away from pains and chasing pleasures, when we now realize life is not only pleasure, it is interchanging between pleasure and pain, now I'm not going to run away, or I'm not going to run towards. If pain comes, let me face it to the best of my ability. And if a pleasure comes, I know I'll try and enjoy it, but I won't push myself to enjoy it because it creates suffering for me. So this turning away from the self is the pivot. But the ego takes over thinking, now I must be the perfect human being. I must perfect this new teaching, this new understanding, and starts working hard because it is based on doership. The point is this moment in time when the ego realized what is this about was not in its control in the first place. So there's no point in trying to push things. Even if you think it's for your good, it will happen. That is why Bhagwan said, the truth is simple, and that is the truth. Forget all this deep sleep, waking, dream state. This waking state is a dream. I certainly believe it because it disappears in deep sleep. What we call the waking state is a dream. So which is the waking state? Can someone help me with this question? The sage lives with this knowing that these are all states. They come and go. They are not reality with a capital R. Someone who follows these talks sent me a mail saying, I came up with a new word, ruality. Your talks are a cross between reality and duality. I said, it's a good one. Ruality. Because the real is always ever present. It is right here, right now. Even when your mind is most troubled, it has not gone anywhere. But this realm of duality is very troubling to the ego because it's constantly being buffeted between the two polarities. And so what was simple duality became complex. That is what happened. And this is a revertal back to simple duality. That is all. Yes, Hamza, would you like to add anything? Oh, sorry, Bijal, we wanted to after this.
I just wanted to talk about this sleep state and this waking state. It's also said that Carl Jung says that what comes to awareness never repeats as fate. So when you're aware of this being a big dream, this waking state is actually a big dream, because what happens is we take everything very seriously. This is also art of being lighthearted and realizing that it's all a play of consciousness, as Swami Nityanand says, you know. Everything is just happening. It's like a drama. And the problem is somebody is directing that drama. But we try to become the directors ourselves. We are just, like we say, puppets or on the stage. And we have given a script. Now the problem is that the actor takes the script very seriously and it gets emotionally involved with that script. Then he will go, like, as an example of Dilip Kumar, when he was doing tragic roles. And he did it consistently and very well. He had to go to a psychologist because the psychologist recommended that don't do tragic roles anymore because it's affecting our mental state.
Because he was so identified with that.
Identified with that. And so he started playing lighthearted roles. And that's in his biography also. So this is what, so Carl Jung's statement, what comes to awareness never repeats as fate. We all have this inner child with us, because as we are growing, before 7 years, we don't have a critical filter between the conscious and the subconscious mind. So everything is recorded as an experience. So those experiences, if you've been abandoned as a child, your mother says, I'm going to come back. These are case studies. I'm going to come back in 5 minutes. And the child is understanding. He cognitively not, but subconsciously, yes. And the mother takes some time to come. He feels abandoned. So through his life, he'll have that abandonment issue. That's what we call samskara of this life. So the thing is, this inner child gets lodged in the triggers, like ma'am was saying, they're triggers. So supposing you're in a class or your friend says, I'm just coming back. And a friend doesn't come or doesn't return your call, that childhood memory, that inner child gets triggered. And that's where we have to work on ourselves and realize what is our inner child. So again, about suffering. Sorry, I just wanted to add there. Every great scripture and every great master has been born in the belly of pain and sorrow. So Gita itself was the anguish of Arjun. Otherwise, Gita would never be born. Because he said, Nanakam Shevajiyam Krishna Najarajiyam Sukhanecha. He said, I don't want. He was in so much anguish, so much pain, that the first chapter was only of his pain, Vishad.
Like Siddharameshwar Maharaj said that 9 months in the womb is pure suffering. That is the start of our journey.
That's the start of our journey. Because we know that we are coming to a, this is a plane of, it's a karma, it's, which we call our, Kurukshetra. So that it was very allegorical because that Kurukshetra actually is our Kurukshetra. And there's a Mahabharata happening every day.
As she said, as she rightly said.
It is happening every day, but the drama. And when does Krishna open his mouth? Second chapter, seventh verse, he says, now I become your Shishya. But that said, it's called Samarpan. That is called Thy Will Be Done, as you said. Otherwise, till that point, Krishna was quiet. He was allowing him to purge his emotions and went. And then Krishna took over. Arjun hardly spoke. It was more Krishna speaking and taking him to the stages.
And like you said, these scripts which we are handed out, most of us don't like the roles we've been assigned. So we have a big complaint with the director.
Because we identify so much. There's a very interesting story, no? The Ram Leela in the village. The Ram and Ravan are fighting, but behind the stage, they are having chai together. And so this is how even Jesus Christ. Now, today, Judas has become the villain. It's a whole theory that he had set Judas up because he had to get crucified. But in spite of knowing that this was his destiny to be crucified, he still has that agony in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's sweating profusely, as Gospel of St. John says. And he goes up. He tells Peter, stand with your sword and fight those people. And he goes up and he puts his head down in surrender. Again, that surrender is a very important thing. And he says, Thy will be done. And he's feeling, he knows this is my destiny. So all the time, this is a pain which propels, even in the Sufi tariqat, they say that there's a verse in the Quran which says that the Prophet felt abandoned because everybody was rejecting him, is his message or whatever. And then the verse came saying that we have not abandoned you. Don't go into depression because this is your destiny. So this is how we...
In fact, Sai Baba would say the same thing, that I cannot change your prarabdha. I have read these words, but if you tell people, they can't relate to it because they say, oh, but he did so many miracles, why can't he do for us? The mind just goes into that zone. He himself has said, I cannot change the prarabdha. What you are meant to go through, you will go through. But can you imagine that you are fully aware what I have to go through, I will go through, but you are in Baba's hands while you go through it? Could someone ask for more? You see, this point gets missed because people want the guru to be the rescuer. The guru is not the rescuer. The guru is the lover. What do I mean? The guru is operating from pure love. The guru, he or she will help you to the best of their ability, whether it is a Sufi master, whether it is this tradition, whatever it may be. But the guru knows you still have to go through what you go through. But the guru also knows that with the teaching as a cushion, you will not accumulate more doership and karma. Your stockpile of sanchit karma, you will not add to through this suffering. This is a very important point. That is the cushion of the teaching. So, but the shishya will have no idea about this because the shishya is ignorance. So the shishya is operating more at the material level that, as long as I'm in the sharan of the guru, let what has to happen, happen. But the shishya does not realize that the guru is actually a space of consciousness which is holding the shishya while the shishya is going through their prarabdha. Prarabdha has to be gone through. But in that, fresh action-reaction loops will not be created. It is like meditation itself. It is a known fact, if you ask some masters of meditation, that in meditation, karmas can be burnt up, which you then don't have to face in the outside world. Why? Because in that state of witnessing, things arise, are witnessed, and then they drop. So it's the same thing, that nothing fresh is being perpetuated to kind of create further in Anubandhan. Otherwise, the tennis match is going to go on and on and on and on.
There's one more thing which came to my mind when you're saying this about the pain of suffering. tapas, if we have, there's a very common word in yoga, tapas. In tapas, actually, it is in Katha Upanishads, Nachiketa and Yamat speak about this point of fire. And fire is given a lot of symbolic importance in the scriptures. And fire is born out of two rocks. Those days, there was no matchstick, and two rocks actually having friction and the fire coming up. So that friction and that fire as a result is this friction which we face in our life, the pain we face in our life, because that brings us to realize that it's not the outward journey, but the inward journey. Because pleasure and bliss are two different things. Pleasure comes from the mind and the ego, and bliss comes from the soul. So the outside world will give you that pleasure, but it'll also give you the pain. So the true understanding is to go, it's a work in and not a work out, you know. So this is...
Really? It is all inner work. Yes, Bijal.
So for me, I don't understand this witness bit, or I'm not able to stay in that state. But other techniques like, you know, sending out loving kindness, or maybe changing my state to gratitude for other blessings in life. That kind of, because the thought is, do I want to go down this route whenever I get triggered or something's not going as per the way I want it to? So is that doership, or is that...
No, it is what appeals to you. As long as you are clear that this line of operating is giving you peace, that is all. Not only giving you peace, but not taking away someone else's peace.
I'm thinking about my peace right now. I've not reached the stage of thinking about what other people, the compassion that you said, I'm just, it's at an intellectual level. It's not.
No. So for example, if I have someone in my life who has disturbed my peace and I start abusing them and I hate them in the core of my heart, are you saying you're not concerned with that because you'll continue hating them and all because you're concerned with your peace?
No, obviously, because that is causing me pain.
Exactly, because that hate is arising within you. So it is about others also. It's not just about me, but you're quite right. It starts with me. But when I realize that everyone is a me, like I am, then that compassion and sensitivity is bound to arise. When there is this realization, there is only one source consciousness. It is natural. That is why when Nisargadatta Maharaj was asked to sum up his teaching in one word, he said, all that I ask is you don't harm another. He didn't say, all that I ask is you be at peace, be concerned with your peace only. Why? Why did he say that? Why did the master of the highest order say, don't harm another? Because if the realization is there, that to harm someone else means to harm God, because there is only one consciousness, then the game is up. So he took the negative way. He didn't say don't love everyone. It's quite hard to do that. But don't harm anyone seems more plausible. And how do we harm? In thought, word and deed. And what are thought, word and deed based on? Doership. Someone did something to me, so I wish them harm. So he went to the root of it with this simple statement. People asked him very complex questions. Prior to consciousness is awareness, awareness unaware of itself as awareness is aware of itself as I am as me, blah, blah, blah. But simple people would ask these questions. Sum it up in one word. Don't harm another. So whatever floats your boat, if there are so many techniques today, so many teachers, teachings, find that one which A, appeals to you, and B, which you know that I feel that I'm in a better space with this, mentally, emotionally, and I can also feel that I'm managing my relationships better when I am with this particular teaching, whichever it be. Because it is about relationships. You cannot separate relationships from the spiritual journey, because all relationships are a reflection of your relationship with yourself. So the other is married to you. The other cannot be excluded. Your thoughts about the people in your life are within you. They are contents of your consciousness. So what is the content of your consciousness about others? What is the dialogue which keeps going on? You see? Because that is the content of my consciousness. So if I have 10 people in my life and I have problems with 7 of them, that means the content of my consciousness 70% of it is a troubled consciousness. Now, can I really be at peace with that? Or I'm fooling myself? I'm fooling myself because if I feel I've absorbed a teaching and I'm following it and my relationships are in a mess, then I need to relook at what's going wrong. I may not blame myself because, like I said, it's my genetics and conditioning also at play, past experiences in life with people. So there's no blame, there's no condemnation. But the fact is, I'm not at peace. I may think I'm at peace, but I'm truly not at peace. Ego can fool itself. Yes, Atik.
Yeah. What I wanted to ask is, the more I'm going within, as you said, it's the journey within, there's more chaos in my outside world. So nothing works out, nothing happens. And it's the more deeper I go, and then I come to a point, I had this problem with thy will be done. Okay. This is a few years back. I couldn't accept it because first identification with the religion, and the religion says God punishes you, do's, don'ts, this you be rewarded, that, okay? So when I came out of that, I started hating the word God, okay? Then I wouldn't term God as a separate entity. I knew it's all awareness, but I used to hate wording it God. I didn't mind consciousness, awareness. I was very comfortable. Then that acceptance came that that is God. I mean, consciousness, awareness, God is all the same, but not as a separate entity, right? So as this is deepening, the doership, when it goes, I get scared. If I surrender, who's going to take care of my work? Who's going to do this? Who's going to do that? And then I pull myself back. Then I go into that emptiness in my meditation. I get scared. Like, oh God, there's nothing here. It's just isness. Where's me? Okay. And then if I surrender, who's going to look into the responsibility that I have? And I pull myself back. So this tug of war is going on where the identity is refusing to give up. When I realize in reality, it's not there. Like if I have a bad thought, let's say I have an anxiety feeling on my chest. When I go in, I don't see a person. I just see this energy working on my chest. Okay? I know it is the energy. I know there's no person as an entity. But still, those clutches are so strong. It coming out of it is where I'm suffering now. Is I realize, I recognize there is no person inside this body. It's just an appearance. There's no Atik as an entity. It's just this live presence, this aware presence. This is all there is. Eternity. This moment is eternal. I have that experience. Time doesn't exist. I experience that. But I'm stuck somewhere. You know, this dropping of identity. This now is so, I mean, it's miraculous. This now, I'm sorry, I'm just getting a little excited. I mean, this now is so beautiful. It's a miracle. This now I'm seeing you, this live, alive moment. You can't even call it a moment. It's that's it. But that pull gets me in. Then again, I let go. And then when I realize, like now I'm enjoying this moment, this not even moment, this isness. It's alive, it's conscious. But, you know, then the pull comes.
So when you are in a situation which you don't like, whether it is at work, whether it is you have to visit someone, God forbid, in the hospital, and the realization comes of the isness, it is the same isness, then you will know surrender has happened. Then you know, I'm so surrendered to, for example, if I'm working and things are going wrong, I'm so surrendered to that, that my mantra is so be it, then surrender has happened. So that last step, that is still the fear of control.
Yeah.
That is still, you see, I'll tell you, when I went to Girnar is a mystic mountain range. At that time, there was no that cable ropeway. Now there's a ropeway which goes the halfway mark. Apparently, Girnar is about 10,000 steps, give or take. Or it must be more. It's very arduous. I went in the summer when one is not supposed to go. The heat is too strong. And I was with people. And thankfully, I didn't suffer physically as much as the others with me. And one of them was lagging behind a lot. And he gave up almost. But we kept pushing him. Come on, you can make it. You can make it. The last peak of Girnar, he was 10 steps away. And he said, I can't do those 10 steps. You see, because you've done 90 steps, yeah. Let's say out of 100. But those 10 steps, you can see the peak. And you're like, bloody hell, those 10, I can't do. So, you know, we had to sit at each step with him for 10 minutes. And he took one step at a time and reached. So it appears that that last bit is the biggest challenge. But what you haven't realized is those 99 steps before the last step have also happened. So why not surrender the 100th step also?
That surrender is not in my control.
Correct. And that is the surrender. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Then there's no problem. Even when I have a problem and I surrender to this fact that it's not in my control, as I told Seema, that is the surrender. What can I do?
I think Bhagwan would say something very interesting. I mean, I'm not sure if it was Bhagwan or someone was talking about Bhagwan's teachings, but they said you have to take the salami approach, like bit by bit, bit by bit. You can't do full surrender at once.
Better, partial it's surrender, safer. If it's partial, it's safer.
And then
safer.
You realize it's working bit by bit, and then the full surrender, which even I thought was easier on my part because full surrender can be a bit intimidating. And it's
not only intimidating, it can be a bit two ways. One is it can fool you, you know, and the other is it can be shattering to the system, the psyche. Then you may not be able to operate in life. So gradual is best. Even the mother of Pondicherry would say that even when it comes to work and success and growth, gradual is better than sudden. Yes, Rupal, you want to say something?
So, while reading, like, what I have experienced is that the last few years I have got into more peace, even if there is a trouble in life everywhere. But the peace has increased. And everywhere where I go, lead me to a same path which I have been following in my life. The question is that when we say that this life is also real. So though I find the Advaita teaching of peace in life to be a very important thing, and that's the foundation of everything. But when I sometimes read that this life is not real, and when I read in the integral yoga that this too is real, this too is Brahman, and this too is actually the reality where you interact. And as in the eight breaths we say that I am the creator. The creator is within me, in the heart of me and everything. And when I look at from that perspective of being a creator or being at that state, then divinizing of this life or in gradually which will happen. So it's not going to happen like I say today and it will happen. But I look at it as a long and a slow path in what it says in Savitri. It's a very long and slow path. But that perspective of having a divinizing life on this planet and even carrying that aspiration in the hearts of many or some will have actual impact in that end of things. So I have taken it very slowly, but somewhere when I read and I find that, so for me the readings of, let's say, the affirmation of the eight spiritual breaths and what I read in Aurobindo or Mother is more like what we have, what is in our spirituality, what we have missed is that this too, interaction with people, interaction in business, divinizing the business, divinizing happiness in business, peace in business is something which needs to be done.
No, you are quite right. When you are in a dream, the dream is real. Everything is Brahman. The unmanifest source is now in multiplicity. manifestation is a reflection of the one source within itself, so it cannot be unreal because it is within itself, not apart from it. When Advaita talks about it being unreal, what they are saying is this is not the only reality. The perspectives of communication are different. Now, how in Advaita are we divinizing life? Wouldn't you say that when the sense of doership is uprooted and the total acceptance of the will of God operates, thy will be done, that is divinizing life? So in business, when you realize all ups and downs are God's will, all your colleagues are instruments of the same God, so are your clients, so are your suppliers, your relationship with them changes, you are divinizing the relationship. So it is the same, but the approaches are different. There is a misconception in Advaita of it being the negative way. But the negative way is expressed so that it is made clear that reality with a capital R is not only what you see, hear, taste, smell and touch. There is something which is far more vast and far more beyond it. So it comes to the same thing. The expressions are different.
Yeah. So someone asked Sri Aurobindo that how many people are there with moksha? So he said, there are many in my ashram, but that is not our goal. So if I look at the continuity also, because when Sri Aurobindo went to the jail and he found these teachings from Vivekananda himself, so that was something which Vivekananda talked to him or told him about going beyond even that moksha.
Yes. And in fact, Vivekananda's teachings were on Gyan Yoga. There's a book called Gyan Yoga Vivekananda. So these are just labels and expressions, but divinizing, this teaching is also about divinizing life, divinizing my relationship with people, my relationship with what happens in my life, and my relationship with myself. And how do I divinize it? When I have the total acceptance that it is the one source consciousness operating through it all. So then you have a double bonanza. You have both approaches working for you. You'll go even beyond moksha to wherever.
But Sri Aurobindo was also like, in his teaching, which it says that peace is the most important foundation. Until the peace is there in all your beingness, you cannot proceed, or that until the peace comes everywhere and you have peace in everything. Because I think he lived a life where there was, in his life, the India was getting partitioned, the world war was happening. So he was in the midst of the most violent phase of life, in things around him actually.
And I know many of his followers who say, oh, peace is the kindergarten. It's the first step. He has charted out the course, but please first be there.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. It's good to talk. It's easy to talk. But what about your own life? What about your own relationships? Where you stand right here, right now, are you at peace? Then we can talk about all the other states of consciousness and samadhi.
So I have given up thinking about all this. My whole thing is that, am I peace at myself or not?
And the rest will follow.
Rest will follow. Let's surrender to the mother, whether she takes it.
That peace that passeth, that surpasseth understanding, where the logical mind gives up. I can't make sense of life anymore. I tried. It is basically makes no sense. I stop looking for cause and effect relationships and figuring life out. Then peace starts dawning, knowing that a higher power is at play. Yeah, who wanted to ask?
For me, understanding, like while I was listening to you all these years, one thing I found very difficult to understand, that God's will. So I used to wonder how. Because what I learned was that it is your actions that you will take to the grave and you will be questioned. That whether you have done right or you have done wrong, and you will be judged based on that on the day of judgment. So understanding God's will was very difficult. But then as I started listening to you and understanding the concepts of Advaita, it helped me understand that concept. And today, one basic example I take when it comes to surrender, that even our own body, our breath, and everything that is currently right now happening inside my body I have no control on it. Forget control, I don't even have an awareness about it. How does my kidney operates, or even while I'm talking, I'm breathing also. When these things are not in my control, then anything in my life, I feel that, how do I even think I have control on that? So that brings immense surrender. And second thing which I learned was, there were repeated patterns in my own life. And I was getting similar question paper every time. So answering that question paper in the same pattern again and again was bringing me to the same pain and the same problem, and projections of my pain into other people also. But when I brought awareness in my life, I understood that pausing, reflecting, and going inside and looking at what is happening inside made me answer the same question paper in a different way. And then I felt that, okay, I think this time I attempted it, same paper had come, I attempted it in a different way. And then I felt different. I felt peace. And not just for myself, for the other person, for other people as well. So this is like my own journey with Advait, that I really love. When in daily living, there is a, of course, I mean, last time I had asked you this question, then I got disturbed because I did something which I felt was not in alignment to, you know, my other teaching. But then again, when that also happens, I'm now learning to pause, reflect, and accept that, yes, that will also, that can also happen, and look at it in a different way. And coming to satsang and listening this, I mean, everything is part of the life and journey, and it bringing a lot of change. So it's like evolving, like in circle. So it's a slow journey, like as what Siddharth was saying. It's a slow journey. It didn't happen in a day, and not even happened yet. It is just happening.
Beautiful. It's all similar. When I sit with my Sufi mystics in Kashmir, like this young boy, one of them, his what they call Peer Saab, I guess, is the equivalent of a guru. Once when he was not able to attend his satsang, he made this boy sit in the seat. So last time I went to a garden, big garden, he got his flask with tea and biscuits and all that, and we were chatting. And he was so sweet. He said he's learned the tradition Islam, traditional way and all that, right? But he said, I started seeing your videos, and in our teaching, this focus on I am is not there. Means the it is there, but from the expression of this teaching. So he said, it's all the same. My Peer Saab talks about the same thing, but the words are different. The delivery is different, you know. So it was such a joy that it's all the same, but it's the interpretations, the conditioning, which behind it all creates these segments.
I would like to add that so every Ramzan while I'm fasting, I also read the translation of Quran. So this time when I was reading the translation, I read from the perspective of understanding that how Advaitic principles, because Quran itself says La ilaha illallah, which means that there is no other than one God. So when I was reading Quran, I was trying to, you know, jot down. I mean, I've not jotted it down, but marked what were the verses which are directing us towards Advait. And it's not different. Like we, like it's just talking the same thing.
It's all the same.
It's all the same. Yeah.
Another mystic I met, she's a lady. She has a, one of her disciples is 32. And he speaks good English. I just made his acquaintance recently. So he said, I tried watching your videos. You know, it's all new to me. But he said, the first time I met you, I knew I had found love. So I told him, try telling my family that. Now, see, these words are labels. They are loaded. But that feeling is prior to words. So the base is that. Now, when we say love, we think of a dualistic love. The Sufi's love is the love for the beloved, the love for God. So they are operating only from that level. A recognition happens. So I am as much at home there as I am at home here. There's no difference. I have been given a name also.
Gautam is also the most what piece you said, which is the basis of and starting point and the most important point. So
you said peace is the most important point, which is neglected and people don't give it that importance. Actually, every religion starts with peace. If you go to church and you say peace be with you after the mass is over, shalom in Jewish tradition, shalom is peace be on you, salam in Islam, and anand in this thing. So it's all about peace. The starting point is peace and the ending point is peace. And with peace, your mind will be harnessed. It will come to sayam. Because if you are always in conflict and always trying to, you know, be in a agitated state, but the moment you harness the mind from the rag, dvesh, and come to that balance of sayam, then you're always at a peaceful place. And then only the... And as she said, there's Advaita in the Quran. There's so many verses which talk about the oneness. It's the same Brahman, concept of Brahman, which is the expanding universe. Triyati in Tantra, which says liberation, expansion and liberation. Tanotri and Triyati, same thing in the... So there's no difference, actually. Yeah. Manufactured differences, you know, so...
But, you know, like at Rameshji's satsangs, many Westerners came. And their biggest load was guilt and shame because the church made a damn thorough job of making them shameful and guilty. So when they came to him, I have seen it, how they just broke down. Like elderly people, you could just see that this whole thing collapsed when they were in his satsang, what they were carrying. All that shame, going to Sunday church, being told this, that. And it was very moving for me to see that they were fortunate to have a destiny to come to India to meet him, be open to his message. And they were transformed overnight. These things cannot be gradual. You hear something and something just cuts through your past conditioning like a sword. That was intense to watch. That I remember, and that instance I've spoken about in the past about a soldier from the Second World War, some war, who lived the rest of his life with guilt at having killed enemy soldiers. And that's what brought him to satsang. And when he heard that, and he had confessed because, you know, Ramesh had this deep interest in knowing a person's background. So that man, because I was there, it was a Sunday, said, my grandfather was in the army. So he explained to him, he said, your entire conditioning is that of being in the army. You were in the cadet corps, whatever, when you were young. You were enlisted in the army and you were assigned to do a job. And when he was told you're not the doer, that man, I still remember his face. He had white hair, wrinkled face, and I think a crutch. He had come with a crutch and someone had accompanied him. When Rameshji left the satsang, he just was a bag of tears. It was like he had been freed. So sometimes, just like different religions bring this load of conditioning, even Hinduism has its own load of conditioning. No one is out of that. And they create these, you know, like you said, the word God was itself so upsetting. That's because of what we've attached to these words. When these labels start dropping away, these attachments start dropping away, then we really become free. It's really amazing. Really. Yes, Priya. Of course.
So, this is about a friend who... It took a lot of courage for her to express on our school group that she was bullied in school. And from the time she was a child, she lacked confidence, and it's taken her a lot of inner work to be able to even find a way to express herself.
So she expressed herself recently?
Yeah, just yesterday. So I wrote this poem, but I was at the
point. This poem when you read her expression of being bullied,
and how she said no harm meant to all the girls in my class, but she suddenly, it was like a dam broke of all that pain. And just at the time when she wrote this, I was listening to your lecture. And so I wanted to write, and I didn't have the courage to send her this poem as yet. Maybe when I meet her, I'll read it out to her. But I was listening to the knowledge you were sharing, and then I wanted to write. It says, the girl with the mirror. The girl with the mirror. A timid and gentle soul, a bud on a fragile stem, impatient waiting to open and be whole once again. To be seen, loved in presence of gratefulness, for her kindness, for her perfume, for her softness and her bloom. The world mirrors her smile, hiding in mists of veiled abiding. The clouds of separations shall soon lift to reveal his timeless gift. When petals of pathos fall away, nothing remains but Guru's light that holds joyful sway.
Well, I was the first one to tell her that you were my dearest friend in school, and I was very blessed to have you as a friend. And even though we don't meet, the fondness will always remain, and you're a very beautiful person inside out. And I could sense that the guard just dropped. And then it opened up others to say, you know, we all share in our own way or bond with you. And, you know, I think she just needed that space to feel loved again. And, you know, it's very rare to be in a space where people feel safe to express.
Yes.
Actually, when, like, before you even speak, we all perceive that intense feeling of love and safety, which we may not experience in the outside world. That's why we all get drawn to the satsang like bees to the, you know, nectar, because here we are ourselves, we are whole, we are back in our true soul, we are back in that one consciousness, and then we get fractured and fragmented when we go outside, and we have to keep using this space as a point of reference, keep using your videos as a point of reference to reconnect to that energy, so that peace that you speak of and the love that you speak of is really, it goes even beyond words. It's just a feeling.
True. Because here nobody is being judged.
So I have one, this, though every religion speaks about peace and harmony and everything, but if you look at the world, today is the most violent time which we have entered. And so first I used to, I asked this question and to myself also, that what should be our role, because the incidents of Pahalgam or things which are happening, though we can try and be peaceful with ourselves, but how do we reconcile with it?
We are concerned with our own peace. You see, this question has been asked even at the time of the Crusades. And still, human beings, as is their nature, are full of conflict and war. So this is the age-old question, what can I do? Walk where your feet are. Stand where your feet are. Be a beacon of peace unto the world, is what Joel Goldsmith would say. May your presence be a benediction wherever you go. That is all we can do. Be an expression of, if you have a guru, a master, be an expression of the master's teachings, whether it is Sai Baba, Sri Aurobindo, Ramana Maharshi, whoever it may be. I was with a devotee of the mother of Pondicherry recently. Now, I have my own lineage, my own parampara, but I have read a bit of what the mother has written, not the voluminous books, but you get these small booklets in the shops, and a lot of things have appealed to me. And one day I was sitting with her and she said, you know, she said, I must confess that here only devotees of the mother come and you don't fit in that category, but I find you are more devoted to the mother than most of them. So what I'm trying to say is that whoever is your master, whichever form of yoga you follow, be devoted to that and live that. That is, in times of trouble, that is what will save one. And it is also true that while there is a lot of conflict, there are more and more people coming on to the spiritual path. So that is simultaneous. We should not take on the troubles of the world upon ourselves.